Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 18, 2018. The government of South Sudan shuts down international media in Juba and Wau.
The BBC has not been paying its rent here in Juba. And I think usually this is the case. If you don't pay your rent, you are cut off. You have to pay your rent, then go ahead. But if you don't want to pay your rent, then I think that is also going too far.
And farmers in Yei complain about bad seeds.
I have planted 3 times in my land, but all the seeds I planted could not germinate. What we want is for the NGOs to bring us good seeds.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese lawmaker and former veteran journalist is supporting the recent crackdown on local and international media houses in South Sudan. Alfred Taban says any media house that does not follow South Sudan's regulations should be shut down. He says the South Sudan Media Authority has the right to punish media houses refusing to obey South Sudan's laws.
Things have improved, but only that, you know, there are administrative problems that have cropped up.
Can you elaborate more on that?
Yes, when you talk about this closure of the BBC's broadcast, which was announced yesterday, the Media Sudan Broadcasting Corporation and the Media Authority, the BBC has not been paying its rent here in Juba. And I think usually this is the case. If you don't pay your rent, you are cut off. You have to pay your rent and go ahead. But if you don't want to pay your rent, then I think that is also going too far.
The UN-sponsored Radio Miraya, we understand that their frequency was suspended. And right now in Juba, if you tune on to Miraya, you hear a different signal. The signal of Miraya is being jammed. Is that also having something to do with the payment of rent?
I don't know about the jamming, but I know Miraya was saying they are a UN agency and they don't need to register. But the media authority said no, they have to register. I think they resolved that, and I think Miraya resumed. Jamming, I'm not hearing of any jamming, I don't know. Morning, I listened to Radio Miraya, and it was out very clear. I could follow it very clearly. So I don't know about this jamming you're talking about.
And as a lawmaker, you're aware of the SOFA agreement, the Status of Forces Agreement, which Miraya signed with the government of South Sudan, and it clearly indicates in that agreement that the UN will operate its radio the way they want, and this agreement is being violated.
The Media Authority and Miraya Radio were able to resolve this case.
Let's talk a little bit about the Media Authority. I remember myself, you, Jacob Akol, and other journalists went to Rumbek to meet and see how the media in South Sudan can, you know, regulate itself. And that was why the idea of the Media Authority came up. But the Media Authority is now cracking down on the media. Is that their mandate?
The Media Authority was formed to regulate the media environment, but not to oppress. And I think they have been doing it relatively well, although with some difficulties here and there. These media houses have so much been used to not being charged. I mean, if you don't register your media house and you want to operate, where does it happen that you can do that?
All the institutions under the media bill are answerable to the parliament, including the South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. The parliament is their oversight. Is the parliament approving the behavior of the media authority in the country?
Yes, you are right to say the media bodies are answerable to parliament. That is absolutely true, answering to the Committee of Information and Communication. And when Miraya Radio was shut down and the Union of Journalists was also shut down, got the information that they had not completed their registration. And we went back and told the UJOBS, the Union of Journalists, your registration. And this was completed.
I hate to get to personal questions, but I have to ask this for the sake of the listeners. You have been a champion of freedom of speech for quite a long time. You have been advocating for freedom of speech in South Sudan. Now that you are a lawmaker, the tone has changed.
Yes, indeed. My fight, my struggle for freedom of expression remains. I still am a strong proponent of freedom of expression. But freedom of expression also does not mean lawlessness. It does not mean people disregarding regulations of a country. That regulations and not pay rent, and you are punished for that, I don't think you will come to me for defense. I will not defend you.
When I look at the situation in the country, it looks like there is a deliberate targeting of international media.
I do not believe so. I don't think it's true.
But the media authority, the media authority refused to give accreditation to 20 international journalists who wanted to go to South Sudan to report on the effect of this war on the ordinary people. It's on record.
Yes, this accreditation of journalists, we learned a bit about, it was last year, I think in January or February, when the media authority refused to accredit. I was not yet in parliament during that time, and I remember we met the media authority and we said, please, you are now a journalist. They said those that they did not accredit had problems with South Sudan, and we said, no, they still should be allowed in. So we took care of that. Let's say this year, is there any report of any journalist who has not been allowed into the country?
But there are reports of journalists who are South Sudanese who work for international media organizations in Juba. They are being required to get accreditation. I mean, how do you accredit yourself in your own country?
If you are a local journalist, you may be accredited for a specific function. If there is a function, let's say, taking place, you go and get accreditation for that specific function. So that is where accreditation is required.
The media authority is asking all South Sudanese who are working for international media to get accreditation from them. That is what is on record.
I don't recall that, and I don't know.
I mean, that's the situation, and that's why I was saying this is a deliberate targeting of international media. That's Alfred Taban Logune, Member of Parliament representing Kajukeji County in South Sudan's National Assembly. He was speaking with me from Juba this past hour. An 11-person panel at the World Bank headquarters here in Washington is tackling the issue of gender-based violence during the International Monetary Fund's spring meetings. As Ayen Deng Bio reports from Washington, the panel hopes that a two-pronged approach of setting up microfinance structures for women and partnering with men to combat sexual violence will change the attitudes and help end sexual violence.
The World Bank estimates 35% of women experience physical violence or sexual partner violence or non-partner sexual violence worldwide. Although solid reporting is lacking in South Sudan, reports suggest at least 475,000 women and girls are at risk, according to the UN Development Program. World Bank Group President Jim Yong Kim told the audience at yesterday's panel discussion that 45 countries have no laws against domestic violence, while 59 countries don't have laws that address sexual harassment in the workplace.
Gender-based violence is a global pandemic. And when I, as an infectious disease doctor, say pandemic, I mean it. It is a problem that infiltrates every single society in the world. Every region, every income level.
The World Bank Group awarded a grant to 11 organizations who will study ways to prevent violence against women and girls. Three of the winners will study the issue in Rwanda, Kenya, and South Africa. Winner and panelist Anita Shankar, backed by Plan International Spain, has been working with refugees in Rwanda. Women there say they are vulnerable to attacks or harassment when they venture out of camps to collect firewood to cook meals. Shankar and her group provide clean cook stove and fuel to refugees, which vastly reduces their reliance on firewood, sometimes by as much as 80%. But Shankar says that may not be enough.
We also know that technology alone isn't enough. You need to have the behavior change. And so that's what we're very excited to have. We have a very unique behavioral intervention that's for both the women and their male partners, and that's really focused on having them understand how their thoughts and their beliefs and their emotions impact their behaviors.
In Kenya, Peg Bevin and her team at Sendakao are examining economic empowerment programs to reduce intimate partner violence. They came up with a transformative household methodology, which helps facilitate dialogue between men, women, girls, and boys in households and communities. The idea is to help people identify the workload of men and women and the social and power structures within the community as a way to help families better understand how a community operates most efficiently.
And really, they're uncovering the inequalities for themselves, and then they come up with the solutions. And we've even seen boys cry doing this because they realize how overburdened their mothers are. So we know that this tool brings very significant gender change in our program. What we don't know is the impact it's having on gender-based violence, and this is what we're working with the Global Women's Institute here in DC to find out.
A simple idea in South Africa is pairing school children with adults who supervise them as they walk to and from school. Zainab Isaac is one of the creators of this program called the Walking School Bus. She says the program creates local solutions for a global problem.
In KwaZulu-Natal, the province in which this work will be done, hundreds and thousands of children walk to school every day, 2 hours and longer. That journey is treacherous. There's lots of social harms. Children are vulnerable to rape, to murder, muggings and bullings, and I think that's not a problem just for KwaZulu-Natal, but the world over.
The Walking School Bus is just one of the programs the World Bank is using to put in place preventative measures and simple solutions to end gender-based violence against young girls and women. Ayen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
A delegation from the African Union visited Juba to encourage the warring parties in the country to end the conflict in South Sudan. For VOA News, Manyang, David Mayar has more from Juba.
The delegation met with President Salva Kiir and senior officials today to talk about how to bring about lasting peace for South Sudan. Minutes after the meeting, Bankole Adieyo, the head of the AU delegation, told reporters the leaders discussed a number of agenda items to be brought up at the third phase of the high-level forum.
We have discussed the setup, the possible setup of the hybrid court. We have discussed the functioning and operations of the national dialogue process. We have discussed how best the South Sudanese can continue to work together and go to Addis Ababa for final discussions.
Adieyo says, since arriving in Juba on Monday, the delegation has also engaged with various groups to figure out how best South Sudan can navigate its way back to peace.
We've engaged all parties, the first vice president, the United Nations mission in South Sudan, the faith-based organizations, civil society, indeed, JEMEC and CITISA. We have been to Malakal. We have witnessed and met the members of the peace protection of civilians communities. We've met with women, youth, children representatives. So we have engaged and we are urging all parties, and I repeat, all parties, to come to the table in Addis Ababa with one goal: to achieve peace.
Speaking on behalf of the Kiir administration, Elia Lomoro, South Sudan's Cabinet Affairs Minister, says the visit by the AU delegation and the upcoming forum is an opportunity for South Sudan's story to be rewritten. He also accused the rebels of not adhering to the rules.
The position of the government conformed to the objectives of the high-level revitalization forum. The rebels did not conform. No one corrected them. We are insisting that this time everybody must be told to focus and conform to the objectives of the revitalization.
Lomoro did not give a clear message about government's full commitment to a hybrid court, which was supposed to be set up months ago, according to 2015 collapse agreement.
We are not shying away from transitional justice or accountability, but it must be done in such a way that the country is not destabilized further by introducing an element of the agreement that could be contradictory to aspiration of peace. So we want to be very clear that we are not shying away from our commitment to the agreement, or we are not fearing the establishment of hybrid court. But it must be logical, must be sequential, and must maintain stability in the country.
The next round of the high-level forum was originally scheduled to get underway April 26th, but the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, in a statement issued on Tuesday, announced that the talks have been postponed and no new dates were fixed. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese farmers say they are getting bad seeds from non-governmental organizations. Find more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think people should be hired based more on work experience or education?
I will place more emphasis on experience, because once the person has experience, you are confident that the person is able to do whatever task given to the person.
Work experience shouldn't be a big priority. And then the education part, it depends on what kind of job you're applying for, such as nursing and law. Things like that require education. You must have passed a certain level of education to acquire that job.
There are so many students coming out of various education institutions. They are looking for jobs with no experiences, yet job adverts are saying that we need someone with 3 years' experiences. So when are these people going to get the jobs? When are they going to get that experience?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some farmers in Yei River County accused the State Minister of Agriculture and some non-governmental organizations of giving them bad seeds. The farmers claim none of the seeds they have planted this past month have germinated. The Yei River State Minister of Agriculture confirms the seeds distributed to nearly 2,000 farmers this season were old. Daniel Martin Friday has more for VOA from Yei.
Charles Logosang, one of the farmers in Yei River County, says he planted maize and beans on a hectare of land last month, but none of them germinated. Speaking in simple Arabic, Logosang says he is frustrated he won't be able to produce any food this season.
I
have planted 3 times in my land, but all the seeds I planted could not germinate. What we want is for the NGOs to bring us good seeds so that we can produce our own food.
A visibly angry Logosang accuses NGOs and the government of failing local farmers. Clement Ayume, who is also a farmer, agrees. He fears many households in Yei River County will have nothing to eat in the coming months because of the bad seeds.
NGOs, if they give our seeds, let us give us the right seeds so that we cease hunger out of Yei. Because if you are not really given the right seeds, hunger is to be the subject of the day.
Speaking in simple Arabic, farmer Richard Bida says NGOs and the government never bothered to test the seeds before procuring them.
The seeds distributed were not good at all. If the seeds are meant to be distributed to the farmers, they must first be tested. They should not supply us with the old seeds. Most of the seeds they distributed are rotten.
Logosang, Ayume, and Bida also blames local authorities for failing to monitor the activities of NGOs supporting the agricultural sector. Therese Desholmes is an international NGO supporting farmers with seeds and tools in Yei River County. Annette Gurin is the NGO's program manager in Yei River State. Annette insists that her office distributed good quality seeds.
We have distributed already 1,500 vegetable seeds and tools, and we are currently distributing 3,000 crop seed communities. So what we receive from our technical follow-up for the seeds we are distributing for the vegetable seeds, it's 95% germination for the vegetable seeds, and we are currently distributing the crop seeds, so we cannot know for now the germination.
The United Methodist Committee on Relief, or UMCO, distributed some of the seeds. Dara Elisa, program manager at UNCO, admits his agency has received a number of complaints from local farmers. Elisa apologized to the farmers and blamed some agencies that distributed bad seeds.
This has been an issue during our cluster meetings that have been raised, but what we've encouraged the partners, that for any city that they brochure, they must carry germination test before it's given to the farmers. We will convene a meeting and we will ask those partners that gave those seeds that did not germinate to procure additional seeds to compensate the farmers.
Yale River State Minister for Agriculture, Catherine Jones, says she has formed a committee to investigate the matter.
The germination percentage is very poor. I even went and saw one farmer who came and he said instead of planting five, but sometimes you see one germinating, others do not germinate. That shows that these seeds have lost their viability. Maybe they are such seeds of the last year.
Joan advised farmers to report bad seeds to the organization that distributed them so the same mistake is not repeated. Yale River State is often referred to as South Sudan's food basket because of its favorable climate and fertile soil. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yale Town.
From Yale, we move to Uganda, where the government there has confirmed that it will receive Eritrean and Sudanese refugees being deported from Israel. There are over 30,000 from both countries who are in the country illegally. VOA's Catherine Nambi has this report for VOA from Kampala.
Despite numerous denials of a deportation deal to take migrants expelled from Israel, Kampala has finally announced it is willing to take on some 500 Eritreans and Sudanese from the Jewish state. In January, Israeli authorities gave the African asylum seekers a 90-day ultimatum to leave their country, go to another, or face jail sentences. Musa Echweru is Uganda's state minister for disaster preparedness and refugees. He confirms Uganda is ready to take in the deportees.
Because of the understanding that the country of Uganda and the state of Israel have very fraternal relations, Uganda said we have no objection. In any case, we have an open door policy for refugee management. And 500 will not be too much, given what we have already accepted from the neighboring countries. Eritreans and South Sudanese will not be a surprise here, because we have already close to about 30,000 Eritreans here. So bring about maybe 200 or 300 of them to join their families here will not be something out of the ordinary.
He says the refugees will either be taken to refugee settlements or left to stay in Kampala and other towns, as urban refugees are free to set up their own income-generating projects.
There are a number of them already in Kampala here who are doing businesses, but we recognize them as our refugees and they have been documented by us. So we will assess them again on a case-by-case basis. Those who might want to do business in Kampala, Jinja, Soroti or wherever, we can facilitate them to do that if they have the capacity. Those who are unable and they want to go and maybe join their colleagues, because Eritreans are mainly in Hoima. There are some Eritreans in Naki Valley in western Uganda. We shall see if we can link them up with their loved ones.
Some Ugandan politicians are skeptical over the agreement between Uganda and Israel, wondering why it has been kept a secret for long. Winnie Kiza is the leader of Uganda's opposition in parliament.
They did not follow the normal channels other refugees have been following. So under what criteria are they being held here?
Earlier media reports suggested that Uganda and Israel cut a secret high-level deal in which it would accept refugees in return for arms, military training and other aid from Israel. However, Minister Echweru denies any material exchange involved in the deportation deal.
Already we have 1.4 million refugees here in Uganda. We have not been paid a cent. In fact, it is us spending our limited resources to make sure that we make them have a second home here in Uganda. So there is no payment attached to this. It is purely humanitarian.
This is the first time that a Ugandan government official has openly acknowledged a plan to host African asylum seekers who were forcibly thrown out of Israel. But there is information published by the Israel media indicating that 1,749 migrants have been deported to Uganda since 2015. According to the publications, 485 migrants were deported in 2015, 506 in 2016, 630 in 2017, and 128 to date in 2018. There are some 27,000 Eritreans and 7,700 Sudanese in Israel. Since Israel took over refugee status determination from UNHCR in 2009, only 10 Eritreans and 1 Sudanese have been recognized as refugees. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
From Kampala, we move to Zimbabwe, where President Emmerson Mnangagwa addresses the nation as Zimbabwe marks its first Independence Day without Robert Mugabe. Sebastian Muofu reports from Harare.
Nothing is impossible, my countrymen and women. Zimbabwe shall rise and be great again. Happy 38th birthday, Zimbabwe. Long live!
That was Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa ending his almost hour-long independence speech Wednesday. Mnangagwa took office in November after the country's long-time leader and liberation hero, Robert Mugabe, resigned under military pressure. The failed economy is a top priority, and Mnangagwa, who spent decades by Mugabe's side, has been quick to distance himself from the economic policies of his former boss. In his speech Wednesday, the president promised reforms to help lure back foreign investors.
Once again, we are free to dream, to hope, and to believe. This new spirit has spread outside our borders, and we are hugely encouraged by the goodwill our country continues to receive from around the world. This renewed domestic and foreign investor confidence has seen our projected economic growth increase from 3.7% last year to 4.5% in 2018.
Mnangagwa did not mention his predecessor, nor did he talk about some 16,000 striking nurses his deputy Constantino Chiwenga fired late Tuesday after they refused to return to work. Zimbabwe is headed for a key test with nationwide elections later this year. In another reversal of Mugabe-era policy, Mnangagwa has invited Western election observers to monitor the process. The president called Wednesday for political dialogue to resolve disputes. Mnangagwa's top rival for the presidency, acting opposition leader Nelson Chamisa, was in the audience and had this to say.
The speech was not for us an indication of what we are, the direction we are taking. He said that they are free and fair election conditions. We actually differ respectfully, and we are going to engage him on that.
The government has not set the date for the poll, which must be held by August 22. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Original. That's our show for this Wednesday. We will end by going to the Democratic Republic of Congo with that song Original by Fally Ipupa.
Fally Ipupa dicap la merveille. Original. Original. Écoutez bien, original.
Get up and dance, dance.
Africa, viens danser. Europa, viens danser. America, les danses. Sud-America, como estás? Asia, hi.
Et pas au Gahaya.
Been listening to Fally Ipupa with the song Original. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also reach us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Original. Abanga ke tumbate abunaka motaka.